Exploring how we can transform our communities in the 21st century with the support of St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Welcome. This is the Community Safety Podcast with your host, Jim Nixon.
Today, the Community Safety Podcast turns its attention to police science. This is looking at how in-depth research can shape policing in the 21st century. My guest has over 10 years working in various police roles, including the role of a police community support officer. Take a listen to a snippet of today's interview.
In policing, a chief constable is there for 3-5 years and then is hoping to either get re-elected or reinstated, or somebody else takes over. So there's a great aversion, same with politics, there's a great aversion to do anything that is only going to show any benefit in the long term. You know, many chief constables would not want to be seen to invest a lot of money into something that, if it does show any success, is not going to be during their tenure. And that is a big problem.
It's now time for the Community Safety Podcast.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Nixon, and I've been working in community safety for over 25 years. This podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest as Suzanne Kanabi-Nicole, also known as the Police Science Doctor. Suzanne has worked in UK policing for over a decade as a police community support officer, regional intelligence analyst, a major crime researcher and an investigator, amongst other policing roles. Suzanne gained a PhD in investigative psychology from the University of Liverpool, and she blended her academic work with her policing career. She has a strong interest in police science and making sure that knowledge is relevant to practitioners. Welcome, Suzanne. Thank you so much for agreeing to come onto the Community Safety Podcast today.
Very happy to be here, Jim. Thank you.
Oh, brilliant. We all start off the podcast by just trying to find out a little bit more about our guest. And I know that obviously you originate from Germany. So I just thought it would be a great opportunity to just introduce yourself in a bit more detail around your growing up years.
Well, my growing up years were very nice and idyllic in what I would call a nice German countryside, cycling several kilometers through the fields to get to school. As soon as I finished my A-levels, I moved to London to do my degree. Originally, actually, the plan was to become a famous musician in London and through music get people to change their ways around how we treat the planet and save the world through my art and craft. And I was reasonable and sensible enough to do my degree at the same time. And I also did an MSc in interactive multimedia, but then dabbled in sort of not very productive jobs for a while because I thought I needed my creative time to work on my music. So when that didn't work out, plan B was to do something decent and go back to university. And I did my master's in investigative psychology then, and then decided to work full-time in policing and do the PhD part-time because I wanted to have the operational experience of working in policing under my belt as well as the academic side, because there's always a risk that if you do everything full-time in university, you come out and you're not really in touch with the operational side of policing and the reality of it, and you only get the theoretical exposure to it. And I wanted to avoid that. So I went arguably the harder route of working full-time in policing and studying part-time on top of that, which took a very long time, but I managed to do it. And as soon as I finished that, I'm someone who always needs to have a big project, similar to the Saving the World project. So the project at the moment is I need to get much more knowledge out there. There's so much knowledge that's being shared by academics amongst academics, which is very frustrating because it's actually the operational officers who are working in policing on the streets and with people, with members of the public, with victims, with offenders who need to know about it. So I thought I'd create a channel where I take the research that is being done, which is, you know, really amazing in many cases, and translate that into something that officers can actually use. They can watch a video that's a few minutes long or even up to an hour long much more easily than they can go trawling through lots of academic research papers that are behind subscription walls and written in very unpleasant ways. And, you know, you wouldn't want to spend your night shift trawling through them, but you can watch a few videos that I produce for you.
No, I think that's an absolutely brilliant idea. And one of the things that really alerted me to your career was the route that you had taken, even though obviously you've gone down the academic route. Really interested to see that you obviously, you know, chose that practical route too. And obviously I can see from your background that you were a police community support officer in London, in the Metropolitan Police. What was that experience like?
So that was going to be filling the gap between, I had decided to do that MSc in investigative psychology, I think around August, September time, 2006, I think. So I had just missed the deadline to join that year. And I was going to then apply and do it the following year. And I thought in the meantime, it would be great to get some policing experience. So I applied to become a PCSO, police community support officer, and didn't realize it would actually take me 5 months to get in with the vetting assessment center and everything. So in the end, I only had about 3 months operational on the streets before I then resigned from that job, because I then moved from London to Liverpool to do the to go back to university. And it was an interesting experience in that it completely changed how I felt as a Londoner, because I, you know, and obviously in London, unless you're really well off, you live in very bad areas, and I lived in very bad areas along with everyone else, but I felt very at home and I felt very safe there. I was, you know, very anonymous and felt quite comfortable with that. But then as soon as I became a PCSO, the first moment I stepped onto a bus in uniform and everybody turned around and looked at me, I felt very uncomfortable because I was visible. Everybody knew something about me. I didn't know anything about them. And I usually preferred the other way around. So I felt a lot less safe than I used to. I didn't blend in anymore. Suddenly, you know, I represented something and I represented an organization. And so that wasn't the right role for me. But it was temporary, and I'm really glad that I did it, because it just showed me a side that the other number of jobs I had in policing after that, they didn't give me that kind of exposure. So I'm glad that I did it, but I learned that it wasn't for me.
What area did you police when you were a police community support officer? What area did you cover?
Notting Hill. So you would have thought, you know, it's I'm sure it is much nicer and busy, but mainly busy with tourists than many other areas. But the interesting thing was that the briefings that you get before you go out, you know, they suddenly draw your attention to people that you wouldn't usually normally notice. And you just start seeing society from a completely different point of view. You know, you're seeing all these social housing units cramped in between these really high-end, very expensive properties in Notting Hill, which in itself is not a bad idea, because we don't want to segregate and we want to integrate. But apart from placing them there, there's no integration going on, really. So there's not much effort going on in terms of getting people up the social ladder. They just stick there and they have the experiences they have. They're still equipped with the skills or the lack of skills that they that brought them into that situation maybe in the first place. So there's not enough being done, I think, in integrating people from more disadvantaged backgrounds and helping them to basically improve their situation, which is not going to be any news to your listeners, I'm sure.
No, it's not going to be any news. And I think there's an awful lot of work, as this is the whole point of this podcast, really, is, you know, trying to look at that as one of the elements. But I think your observations are absolutely 100% spot on. How did you find the police culture when you were a sort of community support officer? How did you find that?
So at the time, that was 2007, I found that the PCSO culture became different later on. So obviously, as I mentioned, I stayed in policing for quite a while, but then in different forces. Some of the initial first generations of PCSOs were different to the newer PCSOs that were coming in, because the newer people who are coming in now, more recently, they may or may not have ambitions to become fully operational police officers. They come from a variety of backgrounds. And there were some on the team that I was on, there were some people who would never have, probably wouldn't pass if a fitness test if they had to do it again. And it's just a, it was the, they were very much in the community role, which is good as well, but they wouldn't have been able to pursue someone, for example. But maybe there was just the particular team that I was on where I noticed that. So I think the caliber has improved in terms of PCSOs, and you know, there's a lot of PCSOs who do want to move on to become police officers, and obviously being a community support officer is giving them great experience and qualification to do that. It makes it a lot easier for them to go through the whole process and selection and training process afterwards.
I think it's a really underrated role myself. I worked as a sergeant for a number of years on a couple of quite challenging neighbourhoods. And I've got to say, my sort of PCSOs were the eyes and ears. They were the ones that would get a lot of the community intelligence, you know, because they were out there. They probably weren't viewed exactly the same as some of the police officers, but they were invaluable to my team, you know, and held in very high regard, not just by me and their fellow officers, but also by the community as well. I felt that they integrated themselves within those communities really, really well.
I think they're very important because, you know, when we used to be able to go out in our town centres, I remember there's one particular PCSO I recognise who's obviously stationed in the town centre, and I've seen him several times, and I would feel much more comfortable approaching a PCSO with something that I didn't think is urgent than a PC, because with a PC I always, you know, I know a lot more about policing than, you know, a member of the general public, but I would feel, you know, they're going to be called off to the next thing. They can't really deal with much unless it's urgent. You know, that you could sort of get that impression that, you know, speak to them if you really have to, or if they're stationary. But, you know, a police community support officer, I think, is a lot more approachable because they're actually there literally to be approachable by the public, to be there standing around, interacting, engaging, getting to know the community. And, you know, that's what we used to do in Notting Hill. You know, we used to go into the shops, sit around with the shopkeepers, have a chat. They were happy to have a uniformed officer seen on the premises, because, you know, it gives them some kind of reassurance, and it sends a message out to the public as well that they've got a good relationship with the police, and it provides the security, and I think it's an important element. And I know that Norfolk Police were the first police force to get rid of PCSOs altogether whilst I was still working there, and I don't know, I can't say anything about whether that has had an impact on anything that that we're able to measure, and I don't know if any forces have followed suit, but I do think there is an element of policing that PCSOs do that is that unfortunately at the moment response officers are just too stretched to do. They're rushing around far too much from one incident to the next, putting out fires, and it's just our policing system at the moment is not set up properly to be preventative. It's too reactive because there's just too much going on, and I think the PCSO role is quite valuable.
I'll be honest with you, Suzanne, I think during COVID, if you take a typical neighbourhood team across the UK, the PCSOs have actually held it all together, really, because I think like you've just said, because of the reactive response that, you know, policing is a lot of the time, your PCs on your neighbourhoods have been sort of redeployed to the more sort of fast response, you know, get into jobs quickly, leaving the PCSOs really to, you know, do the large majority of neighbourhood policing. So, you know, again, take my hat off to them during COVID. They have been absolutely amazing. Certainly the ones that I work with in Staffordshire, you know, have really had to step up to the plate during the last, you know, 12 months, 13 months. So, you know, it just shows what a critical role it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah. I think it's a shame that I absolutely agree that, you know, the NHS are doing an amazing job, the National Health Service, and I appreciate them being applauded and everybody expressing thanks. But it always bugs me a little bit that the police weren't getting the same. And actually, today I listened to a podcast episode with Professor Larry Sherman, whom you mentioned, from the Cambridge Centre of Evidence Based Policing, who's my boss at the moment, and he. He was saying that an American organization actually estimates that even though we've known for quite a long time that doctors in the medical field should wash their hands when they go from one patient to the next, many still don't do it. And they think that this may be the cause of 100,000 people dying of infections per year in America. And I thought, well, hang on. So we've got 100,000 people dying because doctors are not washing their hands per year. And we've got one person killed due to negligence or stupidity or whatever it is in George Floyd by a police officer. And we've got riots going on all around the world. And the proportionality is not there. And it's just interesting that the police are seen as this one organism that is responsible for everything that a single police officer does, and the medical field isn't. And it's just very, very interesting to see this discrepancy there, and a little bit unfair.
I'm glad you picked up on that, because I've had similar, obviously being a police officer for 20 years, you know, it's in my blood, you know, it's something that I will always be immensely proud of. And I'm still one of them at the end of the day. And I still work with them, you know, every day of my career at the moment, in the role that I do at the moment. And I really do think the police have had a really bad time during COVID. I think they're in a very, very difficult situation where they've got to police the COVID restrictions. They're trying to do their best. And I really do feel that they have come out of this looking, you know, really bad, when all they've been doing, you know, trying to do is just do their best. And, you know, I think you'll agree, it's just a no-win situation for them, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. The whole way that policing is viewed, it really needs an overhaul. And I think there's a lot of that needs to be done in terms of educating the public and just getting some proportions right. But I think the media, and, you know, I was speaking to someone yesterday from the US, the media coverage, I think, is so irresponsible, is so polarizing. And you know, I'm not saying I cover the media greatly here, you know, I for example, don't have terrestrial television, so I don't flick from one channel to the next watching the news. But it's just shocking how opinionated media coverage can be officially, legally. And it can really get people wound up, and they end up doing things and believing things, you know, just because someone says it who's standing in front of a microphone on a screen. And I'm just waiting for the day when the media will be really held responsible for what they are doing. And I know they tried to do that when Princess Diana died, you know, with the paparazzis potentially following her and you know, potentially contributing to the fact that the car crashed. I don't know if that really got anywhere. I think there was you know, a spike in interest in this, but it's just amazing what is going on in the world. And there's, unfortunately, it's so wrong. And police officers have it so hard, like you say, not just policing the COVID restrictions, but still having to interact with people. When, you know, if you're working in a hospital, if you're working in the NHS, you've got your full PPE kit and you change it after every person that you deal with. Maybe there's something you can spray in the room once the patient leaves. As a police officer, nobody's giving you that courtesy. Nobody's cleaning anything out before you have to go and deal with someone. You know, you're dealing with people as they are. And the police usually deal with people at the worst moments in their lives. So, you know, nobody's taking any precautions as a member of the public to the safety of the police officers. And I don't think they're appreciated enough for what they do. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think they've been really at risk during COVID. Like you say, you know, you've got to attend something, you know, they haven't got the same PPE that the NHS staff have got. They've been put, you know, in the front line as they are, and they've been put at risk, you know, and I'm just, you know, immensely proud of all the officers and PCSOs that have absolutely done an amazing job. And one thing the British public have got to understand, I know you mentioned sort of the police across the world, but one thing the British public have got to understand is that, you know, we have got probably the best police service in the world. You know, we police, you know, mainly by consent. And again, I'm immensely proud of the fact that, you know, we police the way that we do. And I never, ever want to lose that. You know, it is a tough role, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I left after 20 years, because I could see the way that policing was changing. But, you know, absolute admiration for the officers out there at the moment. It's been a really tough few, well, over a year, isn't it now? So yeah. Really, really tough. Wanted to ask you about evidence-based policing, something that I've been very interested in for a number of years and sort of dabbled with it a little bit. It was just coming in a bit more a bit more the forefront just before I left the police service in sort of 2016. Can you tell the audience a little bit more about it and what it actually means, what it entails?
So it's important here to understand that when it comes to evidence-based policing, we're not using the term evidence as in fingerprints and DNA and CCTV. So obviously that's a little bit confusing because the police deal with evidence a lot. Something being evidence-based, any practice being evidence-based, simply means that it has been tried and tested. In the police, unfortunately, we have a long tradition of doing things the way we've always been doing them, or doing things the way that the person in charge deems we should be doing them. And doing something in an evidence-based way means that you take something that you're doing and you're comparing it to a different way of doing it. And you're doing it in a scientific way where you know that, you know, if there is a difference between the two ways of doing it, our current way and the alternative way, then it's probably because of the effect that the particular intervention has, not because of other factors. So you have to be quite scientific about it, but it's important to evaluate what we're doing, to compare it with alternatives, and then to select the best option. So that's basically what it is. Medicine has been evidence-based for longer than policing has. So you wouldn't accept your vaccine if it hadn't been tested. You wouldn't accept your operation and your other medication if it hadn't been tested and compared to placebos, to others, to not doing anything. But we are accepting policing procedures without them having been tested and evaluated properly. And, you know, is it the right way of dealing with, I understand, and there's a lot of good reasoning behind the taking positive action in when a domestic abuse call comes in. We know that the victim might be uncooperative because they are intimidated. So it was decided, right, to take that decision off them in order to help them. We're going to take positive action and we're going to arrest the perpetrator or the suspect, whether the victim asks us to or not. So I understand that. But there have been studies done that show that you need to be a bit more nuanced, because actually for more affluent people who live in more affluent areas who are at a certain level of society where they have a lot to lose, it does deter them being arrested. It does deter them from offending more than someone who lives in a poorer neighborhood and has far less to use in terms of social status. There, it can actually be detrimental in terms of reoffending, but also to the victim. So it's been shown in a long-term study by Professor Sherman, actually, that when they checked in, I think 23 years later, the victims whose partners were arrested, if they were in poorer socioeconomic circumstances, they were much more likely to die from any kind of circumstance, not through the perpetrator, but from things that could be caused by stress, than those whose partners had been warned and not arrested. So you need to test these kind of things. I'm just waiting for someone to sue the police and say, hang on, so this particular police procedure you exposed me to or my family to, have you actually tested that? If not, then why are you using it? It's irresponsible, perhaps. And in a way, that would actually be a good thing to happen for the community and for policing. Unfortunately, policing changes when they are forced to change. So if somebody forced the police to change and become evidence-based, then I think actually in the long term, that would be really beneficial for policing and the community.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the things that I always used to be quite critical of, and I can probably say it now that I'm no longer a police officer, was I used to feel that sometimes things were quite trendy. You get a new, say, for example, you get a new commander. The new commander would have a new set of ideas. They would then come in. People would then take on those tasks that potentially, say, would want to be promoted. And what we used to see was, you know, the flavor of the month kind of things that would come in. Like you say, they weren't particularly well tested. They would potentially fail, or the results would be kind of average. And then that commander would move on, and then we'd be back to square one. We'd get a new commander in, and then we'd sort of start all over again. Does that sound familiar to you from your research?
Yes, and that is a big problem in policing, that the jobs and posts are very transient. And often they are done. They may lead to a promotion, and then the person moves on, and nobody sticks with the project. That is a big problem, that many things unfortunately are dropped, even if they're working well, because nobody has ownership of them. So that is something that definitely needs to be managed a lot better. And yeah, like you say, it's, you know, the person with the who's at the top of the hierarchy that gets to make the decisions, which is fine, but it should still be necessary to show why those decisions are being made, and, you know, whether they are based on evidence. Are they being, you know, can you show, you know, if they're coming and saying, right, I want to try this, great, okay, why do you want to try it? Has it, you know, has it been shown to be promising somewhere, or is it something completely new? And it's, you know, it's fair enough to try something new, but don't just bring something in because you want to, you know, you want to make a name for yourself. And if you are going to bring something in, then evaluate it. And then if it shows that actually it didn't work, and it's not because of how it was implemented, but because it really just didn't work, great. Actually, you know, this kind of perceived failure is actually really good, because it adds to the knowledge base, it adds to the evidence base. So we need to do these kind of processes. We need to be a lot more brave with trying and testing, and but evaluating things properly. And if we integrate it, researchers more, you know, our analysts who are able to do these evaluations, we would benefit greatly, because especially when it comes to limited policing resources, when it comes to austerity, lots of people leaving the job, the nature of policing changing the way that it has, with, you know, vulnerability and what people do to each other being so much more at the forefront than, you know, than when we used to deal with burglaries and car thefts and thefts of and from motor vehicles. That has changed so much. It has completely different demands on policing and things moving online. We just need to move with the time, and we need to evolve, and we need to become better and a lot more efficient with what we do.
A couple of things for me there. Number one, have you found from your research that the police aren't particularly good at sharing best practice? In terms of, you know, they'll get a good idea, a good project, and it may get shared later on down the line, but when it's still kind of, you know, quite sort of, you know, effective, and it's working well for that particular area, have you found that, you know, they're not particularly good at sharing that information early doors?
The police are very bad at sharing information. There are being great steps taken to remedy that. I work quite closely with the Society of Evidence-Based Policing, and they've got, I don't know when you're going to air this, Jim, but they, you know, there's a 10-week conference running at the moment, and everybody can watch it. It's free. Go to sebp.police.uk. And their remit is to share best practice, to share information. And they're always trying to get as many practitioners in as speakers as academics. But it's harder to get the practitioners to come in than academics, because I actually took an article written by Professor David Kanter. He's sort of the founder of investigative psychology, and he wrote something about a tale of two cultures, academia versus policing. And I turned that into a video, because it's very interesting how that article contrasts how policing and academia work completely differently. In academia, if you find something, it means nothing until you share it, it gets peer reviewed, and it gets published, because then people can see it, people find out about it, and it can be scrutinized openly. The police, they're very, very guarded with their information. You know, they don't, you know, the Professor Kanter was saying in this article, they didn't understand why he wanted to publish a research. They thought it was something to do with vanity. But actually, that's how knowledge is shared. And academia are very good at sharing knowledge, policing not so much. So whilst it's getting better, there's still a lot that needs to be done. And that's one of the things I want to do, that if a police force tries something and has a really good outcome from that, you know, I'd love to make a video about it, because everybody in the world can access that video on my website on YouTube. And that's a way of sharing knowledge. Whereas if they don't do that, you know, how are you going to find out something that maybe Durham did, or a police force in South Africa somewhere did? Where, you know, it's a great project, but they don't really have the, you know, the megaphone to publish that out. And I do. And that's, you know, one of the things I'd be interested in. So if, you know, if any forces are hearing this, if you've got something great you want to share, please get in touch. I might want to share it.
That sounds fantastic. And I think the other thing for me, Suzanne, is, you talked earlier about, you know, we talked about trends and about things coming in. For me as well, it's about patience. It's about testing things, like you say, analysing. Sometimes like any kind of project, it doesn't get sorted and the results don't start to sort of take effect for some time, particularly with some complex issues around policing. And I just think from my own experiences that things were just not given time to, you know, to embed and to see the real results, you know, like I've said, because people would then move on. That particular project wasn't carried on or it was completely changed. So I think that's one of the other things for me that I think we've got to learn from, you know, the type of work that you're doing. We've got to give more time to, you know, these kind of projects to let allow them to grow and allow them to work.
And I think that's something else that is not working as well in policing as it does in the health service, for example. Because if the health, if I don't know much about how this health service is set up, but if something is introduced, it's introduced. In policing, a chief constable is there for 3-5 years and then is hoping to either get reelected or reinstated, or somebody else takes over. So there's a great aversion, same with politics, there's a great aversion to do anything that is only going to show any benefit in the long term. You know, many chief constables would not want to be seen to invest a lot of money into something that, if it does show any success, is not going to be during their tenure. And that is a big problem. And we don't seem to have that in the NHS, and somehow that's really good, because if a new treatment is shown to work better than other treatment, that should be used. And maybe I'm seeing this in a utopic way because I'm not involved in it, but I'm guessing that if the NHS decides, and you know, the National Institute of Care Excellence, NICE or something, if they say this is how it's going to be done, this is how it's going to be done in every surgery, in every GP practice, in every hospital. In policing, it's different. You know, we have different IT systems. You know, we're struggling to communicate with each other, to send intelligence to each other. It's a lot better than it was, obviously, but there is still a lot could be done. And then practices, like I say, the forces are not sharing information that well amongst each other. The collaboration of some back office function is interesting, but again, the investment in long term change is discouraged by the way that police leadership is set up, with having someone at the top of the pyramid for a limited amount of time.
So I think one of the things that we talk about, and probably the listeners are probably fed up of me saying this, but I'm going to say it again, it does say to me that, again, ego plays a big part sometimes in our inability to make progress.
Yeah.
You know,
it does, because you know what, you want to have something to show whilst you are there. And it's just very risky to spend a lot of money into something and on something that you're not going to get an immediate return from. And short-term thinking is always, unless it's really necessary and you need to do something right there and then, much of the thinking should be a lot more bigger picture and long-term than it is at the moment.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is the whole point of this podcast, you know, Suzanne. We've got to start looking at different ways, and some of the stuff that you've been doing is absolutely fantastic, and it's got to be the way forward. And I hope we can keep pushing this, and I'll certainly help you keep pushing this, because the more we get this out to more operational officers as well, the more this is going to kind of stick and we're going to start getting some traction.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Nice. Put it out to as many people as possible.
One of the things I wanted to ask you as well, from your experience of working in policing, I think it's something at the forefront of my mind at the moment, is your views on mental health in policing. What have you come across with your research?
Well, actually, I'm planning a big webinar, a global webinar on that, that's going to take place in May this year, 2021. So mental health in policing is a big topic at the moment, a very, very big topic. And in that webinar I'm hoping to get global perspectives from people representing other countries to talk about the extent of the problem there and some good ideas of tackling it. So I don't want it to be a webinar of, you know, everybody just coming together and complaining about the status quo, but hey, this is something we're doing and this is working really well, and somebody on the other side of the planet can pick that up and think, ooh, okay, I'm going to speak to someone about this, we need to try this. I'm launching the Police Science Doctor Academy soon. So that's an online platform for learning for everyone in law enforcement and related organizations. And the first course, the first proper course I'm launching on there. I've got an introductory course on behavioral science in there that everyone can take now for free. But the first proper course I'm launching is actually with another ex-cop like you, who's a coach now, and she specializes in coaching present or past police officers and police staff through stress, because she's been through it herself, and she was suicidal, and she very nearly did take her own life. But she's come through that, and then she's learned how to do it, how to come through it properly. And that's what she's helping people do now. So that's the emergency stress pit stop course that we're going to be talking about. And you're going to hear me talking about this a lot more, because it's such an important topic, and maybe it has never been more important than at the moment, because, you know, what policing has gone through last year with public hate, you know, almost being public enemy number one. It almost seemed to me at one point, you know, with all the defund the police and Black Lives Matter movements, that people had been locked in their homes, and they finally found a reason, an excuse, and a purpose to go outside and be with others again. And if you're part of a crowd, and that crowd is fired up, you know, oxytocin is released. You're feeling like, you know, you're in the right place, and it feels great. It doesn't have that much to do necessarily about what you're actually protesting against or what you're actually marching for. It just makes people feel good. And I think perhaps there was a tiny aspect of that where, you know, policing, unfortunately, was just the outlet that gave people an excuse to go outside and be with each other against the rules, against all rationality, and march, and, you know, just find something to be upset about, other than COVID and other than Brexit, you know, here in the UK and Europe. So the fallout from that is horrendous. I mean, police officers are quitting their job, probably in the US more so than here, because they've had it so much worse. They're quitting their jobs. What they've been going through. I mean, the job is difficult enough in itself. Police officers are 5 times more likely to have PTSD than you know, the normal member of the public. And you know, you do that in order to keep other people safe. You put your own life at risk to keep other people safe from themselves and from others. And that's why it's partly a hated profession, because sometimes, or, you know, quite often, the police have to do something against someone's will. Other professions don't have that, except maybe traffic attendants. You know, even the medical field, if somebody doesn't want to get treated, they don't get treated, usually, unless they can be sectioned. So that's something else that's unique to policing. Not only are they putting themselves in great danger, but they have to enforce what they do onto other people. And that's why much of it is met with resistance. I've got an ice cream truck in the background. I don't know if you can hear it, but let's just try and ignore it. Let's not have any ice cream now. So I think it's the mental health issue in policing has probably never been as urgent as it is now. So I think I'm really looking forward to that conference. I'm looking forward to that course coming out, because I just can't wait to people accessing what they need. And I've got a friend whose husband is a retired police officer. He's got PTSD, and he needs something like that. And it's difficult for people to access help when it's available. And we're trying to make it as easy for them as possible. They can do it in their own time. It's anonymous. They don't have to tell anyone about it. They can get, you know, they can get the help, the learning, the exercises, they can get the interactions. So we're trying to make it as, we're trying to, all the obstacles that people usually have, especially in policing, for accepting help for what they're going through, we're trying to break these down. We're trying to remove them all.
That is brilliant. I mean, Suzanne, when I joined in 1995, you know, it was a stressful time, like for all young police officers when they first join, you know, getting to grips with, like you were saying earlier, really, the way that you're viewed when you walk out in public in that uniform for the first time. And, you know, for 20 odd years, you've been anonymous, and all of a sudden you are this person. Doesn't matter how young in service you are, that public member of public looks at you and they want help, and they don't realise that you've only got 5 minutes in the job. But also, you know, if you'd had come forward in the 90s and even in the 2000s, really part of the 2000s, with a mental health issue, you know, it wouldn't have gone down too well, really, particularly with your colleagues. And I just want to get this out here, really. I've suffered quite badly with, you know, my own sort of PTSD, mental health issues. I've been lucky that I got out. I've sought the help that I needed, and I'm now in a great place. But I just want to put a message out to any officers that are listening to this today, or friends or family of officers, and they know that they're going through it, is just reach out, you know, don't be afraid. and, you know, do what you've got to do. Think about yourself and think about your family, because it is so important that you get the help and support that you, you know, desperately need and deserve, you know. So I think it's really important that we cover that today.
Absolutely, because the people who come out at the other end, like you have, much better than they went in, are not those who ignore the problem and try to, you know, just bite the bullet and try to put on the brave face. That's how they got into their low. The way they come out of it is by actually doing something about it. And I interviewed this amazing guy from one of the UK police forces, a detective chief inspector, who was talking so openly about having a mental breakdown and getting himself out of it. In a very matter of fact, he said, well, I've been a detective my whole career, so I started detecting what was wrong. How did I get here? What am I going to do about it? And that was just so impressive. And as soon as he went back into work, he flew through the promotion process, and he became a much better person and a much better cop. And I interviewed him about that and put that out there, because I thought so many more people need to hear this and need to do it. And that's why we're calling the course a pit stop, because it's a really good analogy in the sense that you are, as a police officer, you are a racing car. You know, you're going round and round. It's nonstop. And, you know, you know what it feels like at the end of a set of shifts. It is nonstop. Well, how are you going to carry on in the race if you're never stopping to refuel, if you're never checking that your brake pads are working, that, you know, you need new tires, you need new shock absorbers? You're going to be worse and worse at running around the racetrack if you don't get that sorted. So there's absolutely no failure. You know, the Formula One cars are not ashamed to pull over, get everything replaced within seconds. It's such a smooth operation, and they go out there. They need to do this in order to come out stronger, to get back into the race. And that's really what we try to convey with. It's something that will make you stronger. It's something that will make you better. And it's the reasonable thing to do, to come in and get yourself better. You know, that's basically what we need to drum into people's heads. And this whole thing about, I understand it, but we need to change this thinking about, oh, I can't admit something is wrong. People will see me differently. They will see me as this, they will see me as that. But we've just said police officers are 5 times more likely to have PTSD. That means that your colleagues will have it as well. They're just also scared to talk about it. So start talking about it, start doing something about it, and become better at life. You know, enjoy your life more. You know, don't stay in this state. It's unnecessary. We have the help now. The help is available now. 20 years ago, maybe it wasn't so available, but it is now. So, you know, we're removing the barriers left, right, and center. You know, accept the help that's there.
And the other thing for me as well, Suzanne, is that leadership plays such a key role in this. And I actually did see some of that video that you were just talking about with the DCI. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think he actually alludes to the fact that at the time when he suffered his breakdown, that his sort of immediate management leadership were not particularly supportive. And I think that, you know, as a police leader myself, you know, being a police leader, you know, I'd like to think that I would pick up on issues with my team, you know, because I got to know them, I got to know what made them tick. And, you know, I would see differences in them, you know, and I would pull them in when I thought that they were going through a bit of a hard time. And I'd sort of, you know, offer that support and help before it became a massive issue. And I think that's something we've got to get better at in police, in the police family as well, is that leadership and those leaders, you know, start to recognize when people are not quite 100%.
Yeah. And the important thing is that leaders need to lead by example. So I was speaking to Dr. Marla Friedman yesterday. That's I recorded the interview, and this is going to come out in the next few weeks. And she's a police psychologist in the US, and she treats police with PTSD. And they've got a program over there called Chiefs Lead the Way, where the chief goes in for an annual checkup and has a chat with a therapist, and, you know, talks about whatever they need or want to talk about, and then comes back into their force in the organization and says, right, I've just done that. It's great. Didn't hurt. You guys do it now. And they then encourage and lead by example in getting their staff to do it. Now, some police agencies in America are very tiny. You know, there's 18,000-ish law enforcement organizations over there. So some police departments may only have 30 staff, which is completely different to here. But it's great if they can do that. So police leader saying, I'm doing this. I'm having my mental health checkup, and I want all of you guys to do it. That would be fantastic. And then, you know, like an MOT or like a pit stop, you know, go in every year. You know, you're going through so many more critical incidents than any member of the public. You deserve looking after yourself. So we're going to, you know, we're going to cover that. And some police officers offer employee assistance programs, but often police officers feel quite cynical and suspicious. And because it's, you know, done through the organization, they feel it might not be as confidential as it should be, even though usually it is. And so, you know, if they might not want to go to anything internal or to occupational health, but, you know, something external, anything, just go and get that checkup. And it would be fantastic if chiefs could lead the way in that way. And also if, you know, the stress resilience training that I was, you know, the stress coach Jeannie that's doing the course, if that was part of the training from the beginning, that would be fantastic. You know, police officers are taught the law. They are taught how to take statements, how to write statements. But why are we not teaching them about resilience, how to deal with critical incidents emotionally for themselves, you know, how to process everything and then come back into work, or how to see something horrible, how to see a dead child in front of you and then come home and look at your own child. Why are we not teaching them that? That is just as important, because we need these officers to be functioning well, and we need them to be well so that they can actually keep us safe.
I think it's better, but I think there's an awful long way to go. You know, when I compare probably what that process was like when I joined in the mid-90s compared to probably what it is now, it is better. But yeah, I think we have got a long way to go. And again, you know, I'll say this to officers out there, you know, no one's going to give you a medal for staying silent. You know, just reach out. And there is so much help out there at the moment, and it will improve as time goes on, I think, as well. So again, you know, I just want to reiterate that, you know, just do what I did and just take that leap. You will not regret it, I can assure you. And it doesn't affect your career in any way. I just want to give people assurances of that. Can you tell me about your website, and also about the videos that you've been obviously broadcasting, because they sound really exciting. So can you go over that for us?
Yeah, so the website is just www.policesciencedoctor.com or policesciencedr.com. And what you find on there's a page which is called Watch. That's where the video gallery is, and all those videos are freely accessible. Some of the videos are interactive. So if it's a teaching style video that I put together myself, then at the end, if it's one of the later videos, it will actually quiz you. There's a knowledge check integrated into it. So it will stop, ask you a question, and then you have to select the an answer, and it will tell you if it's the right answer or the wrong answer. There's videos on a variety of topics, such as crime linkage, crime analysis, offender profiling, how to interview suspects, how to avoid false confessions, how reliable witness testimony is, what investigative psychology is, how you can use an offender's MO, evidence-based policing videos. And there's a lot of interviews with people that I think have some great value to share. So like the DCI we were talking about. So it's always something where people can learn something from. So the website, because I try to cater to a lot of different learning styles, there's also a page on there which is called Listen. So you can listen to every video as a podcast version, as an audio, like, you know, obviously you're in the podcast room yourself. You can also read the transcripts, because you might want to build up a library of everything that that I've got on there. That page is called the Read page and is password protected. So I've got an email list. You can subscribe for free to the Police Science Doctor email list. And one of the things you get is access to that Read page. So you can get all the transcripts of each video. And that is the timestamps, key learning points are highlighted, and any references are there for you to check yourself. Also the police science snippets. So that's something I've been now doing for 18 weeks. It's really popular. So every Tuesday, I email everyone on the Police Science Doctor email list three golden nuggets that I've extracted from police related research. So, you know, I was talking earlier about how police don't go through lots of academic articles and see, you know, is there anything here that I can use, but I do that for them. So I go through articles and I extract three golden nuggets and I put them into that email, and it's a very short snippet, you know, just a few sentences, but it's something that is immediately actionable or something they can immediately use. So it's nothing theoretical. It's something that's really, really practical and hands-on. So they get that emailed every Tuesday. And again, they can keep a library of those. They can download those snippets as PDFs from the Read page if they're subscribers. And then the Police Science Doctor Academy is the new venture where it's actually going to be a central point for learning on a variety of topics. So we're going to have the how to deal with stress when you're in policing course as the first one. There's going to be a course on investigative psychology. There's going to be a course coming up on investigating sexual offending. And there's going to be a course on dealing with people in crisis as a first responder and a whole lot of other courses. So I'm really excited, and I'm impatient because everything is taking a long time to set up and get off the ground. And because I'm they're not my courses. They are I get together. I basically collaborate with experts in their field. They have the knowledge of what they're teaching, what they have been teaching, what they've been researching. I have the knowledge of and the know-how and the infrastructure ready to actually turn that into an online course and to put it out and to make sure that you can use it as a video and how everything works. And I've got the platform, and so it's a collaboration between the subject matter expert and myself. And I want to populate that with a whole variety of courses for everyone who works in or around law enforcement can find something that is going to be of real great value to them.
I had a look today, actually. I'd had a quick look last week, but I looked again today. And just for the police officers out there, it is a great set of resources, And I think you've tried to keep them quite short as well, Suzanne, so they're not, going to take up too much time. I did some ASB videos last year on YouTube, some antisocial behaviour tips, and I was like you, I kept them quite short, 10 minutes. Maybe 9 minutes, but all the key information, short, sharp, to the point. But I think it really does aid people's learning, doesn't it, when you keep it that kind of format.
Our attention spans are ever shrinking. So, whilst we used to be able to pay attention 100 years ago we used to be able to go into university and try and remember, large bits of information that the reader was telling us. Now, if you're not capturing someone's attention within 7 seconds, you're gone. And so the videos are as short as they can be and as long as they need to be.
Brilliant. I can't wait to watch more. They are really, really informative. And I can understand why you're excited about it, because I think once police officers and anybody involved in law enforcement starts to watch these and see the new content coming through, they're going to get a lot from it. So thank you for putting that all together. We're coming more or less to the end now, Suzanne. Is there anything else you wanted to cover that we haven't covered during today's interview? Is there anything you wanted me to ask that I haven't?
Not that I can think of now. No, it's been a really good talk. And thank you for having me on here.
Oh, you're welcome. I think I'm in awe of the work that you're doing, and just keep doing what you're doing. Your enthusiasm, your passion, it comes through loud and clear, and let's continue to collaborate, over the next sort of, 12 months and beyond, because I think we could do some good work together.
Absolutely. Happy to do that.
Brilliant. And also, can you just go over the best email address for you if people want to make contact?
Yeah. So you can email contact@policesciencedoctor.com. So police science doctor, DR at the end, just one word. But if you don't remember, just go to the website and, find contact details there at the bottom.
That's brilliant. Well, look, this has been a fantastic hour. I've really, really enjoyed it. And I know that the audience would have got a lot from this today, particularly, our colleagues involved in law enforcement. I think anybody that's got an interest in policing and law enforcement will take a lot from today's interview. So just another big thank you from me and from the audience for taking time out today to share your experience and knowledge with us.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you. Thanks again to our audience today for tuning into the Community Safety Podcast. We really do appreciate, you getting involved, but continue to spread the message wide and far. Please rate, subscribe, and like the podcast. Give us a review if you can as well, particularly if you use an Apple device. And continue to sort of, tell your friends, tell your colleagues. We want to share our message, far and wide. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Thank you very much. That was a fantastic interview with Suzanne Kanabi-Nicole, the police science doctor. Such a wealth of knowledge, and so good to see how police science and the research can really form policing in the 21st century. And if we all work together, we can only make policing better as we move forward. I think it was also important as well during the interview that we looked at how mental health has an effect on police officers and how we must crush the stigma associated with mental health in policing and in the wider environment. There is no shame asking for help. And again, I'd urge all officers, if you are suffering, then please reach out. There's plenty of help available to you. Thank you so much again for listening to the podcast. Please rate, subscribe and review the podcast. Please tell your friends, please tell your colleagues. We want to share our messages far and wide. And also don't forget about the website, which is www.thecommunitysafetypodcast.co.uk. And we'll catch you on the next episode.
You've been listening to the Community Safety Podcast. With thanks for support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and MeLearn. Join us again next time to help us explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century. On the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.